Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm privileged to welcome a very, very accomplished and senior official from the Indian Army with a distinguished career, Lieutenant General PJS Pannu, PVSM, AVSM, and VSM. General Pannu, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashutosh, to invite me to speak at The Brand Called You.
Thank you.
Very unique. I don't know whether it is you or me, but I think together we'll make it happy.
Absolutely. It'll be a fabulous conversation. So General Pannu has been the former Deputy Chief of the Integrated Defense in the Indian Army. And as I mentioned, he's PVSM, AVSM, and VSM. And for a lot of you who do not know what PVSM, AVSM, and VSM are, let me quickly say they are Param Vishish Seva Medal, Ati Vishish Seva Medal, and Vishisht Seva Medal, all given by the President of India for distinguished service. General Pannu has commanded 71 Infantry Division on the line of actual control with China and commanded the Corps deployed in two fronts, Pakistan and China together, and is the highest and in the highest battlefield in the world. He served in two foreign missions in Mozambique and Sudan. General Pannu is also referred to or thought of as a thinking general. He's been involved with several think tanks and educational initiatives of the Indian Army. And more recently, he's an author. And all of you know, I'm very partial to authors. He's the co-author of a book titled The Power of Future Machines. General, what an amazing career you've had. So I'm going to ask you by asking a simple question for a lot of our young viewers and listeners, from a young cadet to a three-star general, what did you do right in this journey to the top?
Ashutosh, actually, life takes you the way the destiny shapes it. The opportunities come, the challenges come, and I suppose every opportunity and challenge has to be seen in its own a way that you can respond to.
Hmm.
It is like playing a tennis match that every ball which is thrown at you, you have to respond to that ball to the best of your ability.
Correct.
And continue to respond balls. You know, you can win a match, you can have a tie, or you can even lose one.
Correct.
So I suppose try to return every ball to the best of your ability.
Hmm.
I suppose that is what one has seen in this career.
Amazing. And as, you know, someone who was the Deputy Chief of the Integrated Defense in the Indian Army, what would you say has been your leadership style?
Interestingly, leadership style changes as you grow. Mm-hmm. From a platoon commander, when you initially join, you're a company to IC, and then you are leading a company of 120 to the battle.
Mm-hmm.
So the leadership style changes as you grow up and become a three-star general. You have to play a role differently. So when you are right at the top, actually you are trying to only create conditions for success. It means you are bringing those positives or bringing opportunities or bringing information or help out your subordinates to do well in maximum of what you have in you.
Mm.
But when you are a junior leader, you have to depend on your own small team to bring success to you. So there is a direct leadership between you and the men that you command. It's a collective. Okay. It is a collective success. And I suppose, all in all, when you are a commanding officer, and that is where I wanted to come to, is the command style is 9 and 9.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you see the X-axis and the Y-axis, the 9 is hard taskmaster, task orientation.
Right.
And the other plane is welfare of your men.
Hmm.
9-9 is desirable, very difficult, difficult to achieve, but it is not impossible to achieve.
Hmm.
So it means you're looking after your men as much as they need to be looked after. And you need to be as hard in making sure that they bring best out of them.
Hmm.
So 9-9 leadership is the one which I have looked at. Sometimes you can only achieve 7-7. Sometimes you can achieve 8-8.
Hmm.
But you have to keep changing your leadership style. But when you are in war, I think the 9 of task orientation becomes more important than welfare.
Hmm.
But when you are training for war, or when you are not at war or after the war situation, hmm, I suppose the welfare becomes more important as 9 and task orientation, you can soften a bit. So I think 9-9 is the one which I would want to talk about.
Thank you. So let's talk a little bit about now, you know, it probably also comes from your book, The Power of Future Machines. But my first question to you, General, is how do you envision the role of technology in the future of warfare?
See, we have always believed, and I, being from infantry, we have always believed that it is the men behind the machine who are more important. If the men behind the machine fail, the machines cannot perform in any case. But now that you are going towards the autonomous machines, it means that men behind the machine have to program the machines and then you allow the machine to perform. But I suppose we have not reached there yet. The time will tell how these machines will perform, because the smart battlefields on digital platforms will be a very different paradigm in which our men and machines will have to work. So therefore, the technology is not only what you are giving to your men, but I suppose technology is something which has to be constantly upgraded. It is the industry and the R&D of a nation which has to support, so that you are not lacking as far as the technological edge with your adversary is concerned. Because you can have a good technology, but if your adversary has better technology, then your men would look at you that you have not really provided us what the adversary has. So therefore, the challenge is to make sure that your industry and your nation, as one nation, supports you to have the best technology available. Of course, you know, there are challenges. You know, war and business are another paradigm of discussion altogether, where the industrial complexes which are churning out the weaponry are the ones also contributing to large business of warfare. But all in all, I suppose it is one nation provides the best machine, which is the niche technology, which is an edge over the adversary. And of course, the men have to be the same as they were before. But I think the teaming is the one between man and the machine is the one which is going to be there for the future. If we can team well, I think we will be able to win all future wars.
And do you think the nature of warfare will change in the future? And if yes, how is the Indian Army preparing itself?
The nature of warfare would constantly change. In fact, it is going to be a tease. Our nation is facing hybrid situation. Over two decades, the global understanding was that we're not going to fight conventional wars, and there's going to be a global war on terrorism where all the global alliances came together to fight. As the technology came in, the hybrid situations started turning in, because the technology has made it possible to bring the psychological mind game part, where the mind gets captured, the individual is less important to be captured. So if you start capturing the mind, I think then you're going into the hybrid situation of warfare. And I think our country has transited from the terrorism to hybrid situation about a decade back. The future is going to be high tech, where I think the information warfare clubbed with artificial intelligence and the machines like drones are going to be thrown in, who are going to be actually be the main arm of success. Like somebody said, you know, like we had tanks before and artillery before, I think drones and the missiles are the ones which are going to contribute largely. But I think that will also change as the technology empowers the space and the cyber. So we will have the metaverse coming in. The largely war is going to be fought over materials. Wherever the materials are, wherever the water is, where the resources are, I think nation state would want to extend their territories to that. Maybe even bargain something which is less important or more important. They will find reasons to lay claims on areas where the empowerment comes from the rich materials, the rare earth materials. And I think it will also extend towards the planets. And I think the space war is going to make sure that we start fighting at some point over the resources which are planetary. Scientists are looking at how to really colonize the space, colonize the moon, colonize the Mars. And I suppose that colonization will happen, because we will start picking up the rare planetary materials, bring them to the Earth, and start producing technology which the others don't have. So I suppose fighting over these resources are going to be prime. Mm-hmm. And I think technology, which I spoke about, that coming from space, cyber, and down to drones and teaming, I think mm-hmm. that is where we are going. But it will continue to shift and change and surprise everybody. Mm-hmm. So we are out for a technological shock.
Fascinating. You spoke about cyber as well as space. I'd like to talk to you about both of these. How prepared are we for cyber attacks and attacks, you know, electronic attacks on a lot of our infrastructure? And I'll ask you the second question on space after that.
Ashutosh, I would like to say that we are very well prepared, as much as you can currently, the kind of technology that you have. No nation in this world can say that their cyberspace has not been intruded or not been compromised. I think cyber attacks have made it possible for every nation where they have gone in and attacked some very critical infrastructure. There's a lot of denial which happens, but the fact is that, yes, there is more you connect, more you digitalize, more you're at risk of cyber attacks. And I think this is going to be a offensive defense kind of a thing. You want to enter somebody else's cyberspace, somebody else will enter your cyberspace. And I think that is going to be a constant extension of the hybrid warfare.
Interesting. And I remember reading some time back that the US, under President Trump, had started a space force. And apparently they're spending a lot of money on that front. Do you see India and some of the other powerful nations also developing a space force for the as a part of the defense of India?
The race for space has already started.
Okay.
Earlier, the nations would invest in the government agencies like we have ISRO.
Correct.
And NASA, United States, and of course, all the other countries have their own space programs, which are government funded and government based.
Right.
But what has revolutionized is that SpaceX kind of Elon Musk, you know, individuals are coming in and joining hands with the governments, making money off it, and yet being available to the nation for any space warfare or any space edge technologies which will help nation any which way.
Correct.
So if the president has created a space force, it means that is militarization of space. And in the militarization of space, what is important is that if one can dominate the space, from space you can dominate the ground. And those are now, there are three paradigms of space. One is the space warfare, that is satellites versus satellites and what happens above the Kármán line. And the second one is space-based programs, where whatever is happening in the space is used to alter the course of warfare or decision-making on the ground. And the third one is space-supported operations. It means everything is happening on ground. It is just that you're using space as a medium, such as SATCOM or navigation. So these are the three paradigms. But the Americans are even looking at how to actually transport the human bodies through space, which will take a few minutes to actually traverse half of the globe, or within an hour, the forces can get deployed physically. They would be lifting them into the rocket, goes into the space, which travels much faster. You cannot even imagine faster than the speed of the Earth.
Absolutely.
And then they re-enter and the troops can be deployed. These are the kind of technologies being spoken about, where the human is going to be empowered and augmented to fight a battle, or at least dominate and show presence and surprise anybody else. So I suppose this is what the Space Force is going to do. And any force which uses the space for militarization, and I think slowly all the governments who can afford and who have the technology, who are the spacefaring nations, would ultimately land up being having a space force.
And given the kind of technology that we have spoken about, what kind of training and education do you envisage our soldiers will need?
You know, we are very surprised that those soldiers who we thought would not be able to learn computers are today on smartphones.
Right.
They are all operating emails. We used to, at some point about a decade back, used to ask, have you qualified? Let's run a computer card for men. But today, the way the application of cyber or computerization or the ICT modernization has gone as being necessary for living an ordinary life. You know, you can't have an Aadhaar card, you have to book. Yeah, everything is digitalized, you know, you have to have an OTP. In fact, today you cannot even have an alternative way of living other than being dependent on the internet.
Correct.
If you say there is no internet, it means you can't live as it used to be with electricity, you know, sometime back, which is also as important. So when troops come from the new generation who are already actually using smartphones, so I suppose the threshold has already gone up to a point. So it is not very difficult for them to train because the smartphones have already trained those minds. And the new generation is quite adept at it. So I suppose the training will have to be only how to use these smart machines and smart systems for warfare. And that kind of a training, of course, will have to be
done. Well said. Thank you. Great response. And, you know, given the geopolitical shifts that are now taking place and, you know, different blocks are being formed, the Quad, the AUKUS, and so on and so forth, what is your view on how will these geopolitical shifts impact the future of warfare? And what do you see the military's role?
Ashutosh, global situation is very, very complex, getting more complex by the day because the information reaches faster than it has happened because there's a lot of information warfare, a lot of psychological or, you know, deep fakes are coming in and the attention is drawn or taken away from the actual happening. But in the geopolitical shift, you see, there are consequences of rapid happenings and therefore rapid responses have to come together. Unless nations come together, they will not be able to decide by themselves because you could be actually on the other side of the OODA loop that you have not been able to decide, but your future is already impacted by an happening which you've not understood. So one is that the OODA loop is very sharpened, that is the observe, orient, decide, and act. But in the OODA loop, what is important is OOSDA. Now is being spoken about that you observe, orient, share, secure, decide, and act. Now sharing and securing is how the global alliances will make it possible. That if you're going to share with something with security, then you have to understand who are the partners with who you will be able to partner. And therefore, these groups are going to be very relevant, but also as complex or get even more complex. You do not know whether the person who is supporting you is actually with you or is just posing to be with you. And I think that is where I'm saying the rapid shifts will create rapid situations. And that's going to be a huge challenge to the nation state.
Fascinating. I'm now going to move our conversation to our two neighbors. And you have led our forces against both the fronts of China and Pakistan. Let me start by asking you about China. From a situation in 1962 when we were not very well prepared to now eyeball to eyeball right in front for since 2020, what is your view on how to tackle the challenges China represents on our borders while continuing to do $120 billion of trade between the two countries?
Ashutosh, China, India, and Pakistan, which matter to us in the security business of our region, are very complex countries. Leaving India out, we understand that we have our own challenges of democracy.
Yeah.
So we are a democratic nation. Pakistan is not a democratic nation under the pseudo-democracy. The military pushes itself, but also military has not allowed the country to grow economically and industrial base is very poor. So as a result, the Chinese have walked in after the Americans, but Americans have not pulled out. So both adversaries now are supporting Pakistan and they're not allowing Pakistan to collapse. Not that it'll help us for seeing Pakistan collapse. But the point is, Pakistan is also a firm base for Central Asia. This is where the great game has always played. And today, Russia is what Russia is doing. This is what the Western world had already feared, and that is how they created Pakistan the way they created it. As a result, they are not going to let go of Pakistan. As far as China is concerned, China was really propped up against Russians in the earlier years.
Correct.
And when China attacked India, and also when Pakistan attacked India, the Western world actually turned themselves away from supporting India. Because these are the two areas which mattered them the most, because they were the frontline states against Russia. And if there were two frontline states which were being propped up by the Western world against Russia, obviously India had no role to play there. But what is happening is that the priority of our nation has shifted from 1962, that we did not want to invest in military. We did not understand the importance of having a hard power. Slowly, we have realized the value of hard power. The Chinese have understood the value of hard power, and they have pushed around and have militarized the borders in Tibet. So over a period of time, the situation is that 14% to 15% of the military of the world is actually on the Indian borders. We are nuclear-armed nations. That is how we have stayed away from fighting a conventional war after both India and Pakistan went nuclear. China has been nuclear power, but then Chinese have also realized that there is a deterrent. And therefore, conventional war will have to have a threshold which cannot be crossed. So over a period of time, we are looking at Russia from the Chinese prism. It used to happen the other way around. And I think even the Western world has to start looking. Earlier, they looked at the whole world from the Russian prism. I think the whole world will start looking, or is already looking, at the world from the Chinese prism. And I think that is where the India becoming a frontline state to China and Pakistan has all of a sudden become a very important state. So our own military preparation, of course, is there. We are being supported, not in a direct manner, but I suppose in more favorable terms as far as the global arrangements are concerned. But I think we still do not have that kind of a free availability of technology. We still have to depend a lot on import of technology. Atmanirbharta, of course, is being spoken about, but I suppose unless we do our own R&D, unless we actually build our own Indian materials, a lot of materials get imported from outside, a lot of components which we want to use in indigenous war material are also being imported from outside, such as drones. So I think we can keep talking about an Indian product, but I think within the Indian product, a lot of components are still foreign. I suppose India has to rectify that if we have to measure up to China. And of course, China is a manufacturing hub of the world. I think maybe with this shift which is happening post-COVID and the relationship that the Chinese have now with the other part of the world, maybe if the industrial base becomes strong in India, I suppose we'll have to deal with it. Otherwise, we have challenges at hand. And both neighbors are now together, the Chinese and the Pakistanis. And I suppose that is a very big shift which has happened. And I think India has to prepare for the next war in whichever way it happens.
Well said. And one more question on Pakistan is that, you know, Pakistan is going through a lot of its own instability economically and politically. How does an unstable Pakistan, how does India react to an unstable Pakistan?
Pakistan has been unstable for very long, actually, even from the inception of it. Every region of Pakistan, if I can say, has never been part of one nation. And out of compulsion, I think they had to turn themselves as an Islamic state, because otherwise there was no gluing factor. The Pashtun, the Baluch, and the Sindhis, and the people from the north frontier, and Punjabis, of course, were dominating the others. And they could never pull themselves together. And that is how Bangladesh got created, because they did not accept Bengalis. But then they realized that let's use one common religion as a gluing factor, where again Shia-Sunni divide, and again the lack of development and over control of the military and interference of the West, because West was more interested in controlling Pakistan, and army was being used as a control mechanism. Army got empowered, and therefore there was no development which happened. The education was based on madrasa systems. Science and technology or industrial complexes never came up for the simple reason that they had no idea how to build their own nation. Ultimately, Pakistan has been struggling. For years, we have been hearing that Pakistan is a failing state. It never fails because it gets bailed out by the Western power because it is a firm base of the West because of their great game understanding and the interests in Pakistan. I suppose China and US, though, are at loggerheads, but will continue to bail Pakistan. But leave them in a state that they have to be always dependent on these two countries, and they do their bidding. So therefore, if there's a two-front war, the Pakistan would be asked to do bidding for the Chinese. If there is larger another issue, then I suppose even Americans would want Pakistan to help them out in Afghanistan should that situation go bad again, even against Russia. So, so I suppose we are actually located in the center of the future problems. And I suppose we need to be very, very careful how we pan ourselves, and we should not get into the crosshairs of the superpowers and understand. And I think we are doing pretty well in that understanding. The statecraft is at play.
Well said. So one more question about the soldier, and then after that, I'll move to your book for a couple of questions. It has been said that the Chinese soldier fights for the party, the People's Liberation Army. A Pakistani soldier fights for his religion. And an Indian soldier fights for his motherland or the Naam Namak Nishan. I'd love to get your perspectives.
See, when an Indian officer passes out from the academy, the checkboard tells them that the nation would come first, the soldier second, and they themselves last. As a result, when we go back to our units or go to the units when we join after commissioning, we realize that there are men who become your, they are your religion. Whatever they eat, whatever they do, they become your religion. The officer actually sheds their own religion. And that is how one big regimentation comes in.
Correct.
I think regimentation needs to be understood. I think the strength of a Indian army is on very deep regimentation. You cannot talk ill of my regiment because then you will do anything. I mean, people can say anything about anything else, but my regiment comes first.
Correct.
So therefore, Naam Namak Nishan is the one where you are under peer group pressure. The soldiers have to perform because now that it is the honor of that flag or the regimental flag which they hold, and ultimately the national flag. But what is more important is the men and officer relationship, which is extremely important, which is very different in Pakistan. And most important in that relationship is that the men have to make sure that the morale of their officer goes up, and the officer primarily is looking at the morale of the men. If both work together in synergy, as I say that you spoke about technology also, the men, the officers, and the technology, earlier it used to be a horse or elephant.
Yes.
It is a combination of a man and beast, can never be subjugated.
Correct.
So it is a combination or a synergy between man, the beast or the machine, and the officer. That synergy can never be subjugated. It comes from deep regimentation of a military and deep ethos that we learn from the checkwood.
Wonderful. I'd now like to move to your book. You are the co-author of a book titled The Power of Future Machines. I read a little bit about it, but tell me about what was the hypothesis for writing this book along with your co-authors?
Rajiv Malhotra had written a book, Five Battlegrounds, for the power of five battlegrounds. He wrote a book on artificial intelligence, and where he actually states that those who cannot go on to adopting the new technology of artificial intelligence will be reduced to the labor colony of the world. You will be a have-not, and those who have technology will be haves.
Correct.
And therefore, I got into a conversation with Rajiv Malhotra at that time. So I took that leaf out of it and wrote the chapter on artificial intelligence for national security.
Okay.
Because if you do not adopt or adapt with the future of technology, I suppose to become irrelevant is as bad as being reduced to the labor colony of the world or be a have-not. So I suppose those who cannot, or nations who cannot switch over very quickly to use the power of the machine, which they control, we will land up using machines which would control us, and those machines could actually be owned by somebody else without us knowing it. So data is something which those machines are going to be programmed with. And if we don't have our own data, somebody else is going to use our machines. So don't build machines for somebody else to use. Build your own machines with your own research and development, with your own materials, so that there is no supply chain infection. And use that machine to protect the nation, not only on the borders, but also in the hinterland, because on the battleground, which is based on the artificial intelligence, there's no front. Even the reverse is a front. So every individual is also under threat of being eliminated individually, alone, without any support, without even your neighbor coming to know that there is something which has gone terribly wrong with you. That is the power of artificial intelligence. And smartphones have to be used in a very smart manner, whereas you are smarter than the smart machine. But I suppose things may be going in the other direction. So therefore, it was important for me to write this book and co-author with Rajiv Malhotra.
Wonderful. And I'm going to ask all our viewers and listeners to go and check out General Pannu's book and Rajiv Malhotra's book on Amazon. I will go and check it out myself. And my last question to you, General Pannu, and this is for the many, many people who will listen to our conversation. Based on your own amazing journey and everything that you've told us about the technology, what would you say are three lessons you would want our viewers and listeners to take away from your own life and from all the learnings you've had in the world of technology when it comes to the Indian Army?
I think it's a very complex question. It's been a long journey, 4 decades in the Indian military. One at that time did not know whether you're doing right or wrong. A lot of things that are recognized to be right, and then you get rewarded for it. There's a lot of experimentation that you do with your own life and with your own battalion. And sometimes you are very conscious of the fact that you are experimenting. I hope that things are okay, because the life of your men is very important, because you want that your men should have faith in you. So I suppose one important thing among many is that a leader must have the knowledge, because only then you can show the way. The leader must instill so much of faith that men follow you. And a leader must have that kind of a conviction that whatever you are preaching, men, you're following it yourself. If these three are not practiced together, I suppose the morale will sink, and then there will be a very, great disconnect between the men and the and the officers. Another thing is, the loyalty of men comes from human dignity. You cannot take a human dignity of your subordinate away, ever. That is most important.
Very interesting. And
when you're calling somebody Havaldar Yugender Singh or something like that, but there is Yugender also in it. There is Yogi also in it. There is a son in who you see. There is a father in who you see. There is a husband in who you see. And you are now asking him to do something which is very risky. You have to make sure that he is not the one who's put at risk, but he does the job, brings success without staking his life. And I suppose once men understand that they're not being used as cannon fodder, the human dignity is prime. The families that they have left behind are as important an extension of the family. In fact, the army wives have a lot of role to play, because they keep regularly and be in touch with the the wives of men that we command, constantly on the phone or otherwise. If the husband is not responding, at least the commander's wife is called up by, and they say, yes, everything is fine. You know, they're doing something important. So I think we build a huge family, and therefore army becomes a way of life. It is not a profession, which it is not a job, actually. It is a profession which is a way of life.
Well said.
So the practice goes much beyond than what is normally seen from outside. I think from inside, the gluing factor is that you break your mind into a couple of different personalities that you have, and build one monolith out of it.
Well said. And on that note, General Pannu, and your amazing lessons, the leader must have the knowledge to be able to show the way, to instill the confidence, and to have the conviction. And the next you said was, it is so important that loyalty comes only if you give your people the human dignity. Thank you so much for talking to me about your amazing journey right to the top. Thank you for talking to me about how you have looked at technology and how you see the Indian Army preparing itself. Thank you also for speaking to me about China, Pakistan. And finally, thank you for speaking to me about your book, The Power of Future Machines. Thank you again and good luck.
Thank you, Ashutosh, for having me over on this talk. I enjoyed it myself.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.